2:30 a.m. That's it. That is not in the afternoon. But anyway, so my talk today is focusing on the legal and regulatory approaches to counterterrorism financing in Australia, and I think it nicely actually picks up on some of the points that were made as part of the first panel. And as sort of I suggested in the abstract in the program, I'd like to sort of talk about four different steps, basically just to give you a rundown of what the current legal regime looks like, and look very briefly at the regulatory regime. And I'd sort of make a distinction here between the sort of the criminal law, a criminal justice kind of based system, and a sort of a regulatory reporting system. Then sort of make a few remarks on the substance of that system and sort of reform initiatives and operation, including the number of prosecutions. I was intrigued to hear sort of Clive mentioning these numbers in the other session. What sort of slightly worries me, and that's sort of one of the probably conclusions of my talk as well, is that the number of terrorism prosecutions in Australia are generally half of the number of laws that we've introduced to combat the phenomenon. And I think, I just looked up, because I didn't have the numbers myself, so I just looked up on the recent data, and we have 35 prosecutions, as of 2015, we have 35 prosecutions, 26 convictions, but we have about 50 new pieces of legislation. So I think, and we can play a similar numbers game as far as sort of the counterterrorism financing prosecutions are concerned. And then finally, hopefully, if I have some time, it's a kind of my fourth sort of step of my presentation is a kind of work in progress, and hopefully I have time to make a few remarks in relation to that, but we'll see. Otherwise, I might sort of keep some of it for the discussion later in today in the Q&A session or tomorrow. So the first point, the first two key points I'd like to make is I think the Australian counterterrorism financing legal regime is a complete mess. And the mess is, I think, due to basically, I think, a number of factors, one of which is, I think, the UN and the FATF, and the eagerness on part of the Australian government to respond to basically the international obligations that the Australian government perceived to be under. I'm using the term perceived because, of course, certainly as far as 1373 is concerned, Security Council Resolution 1373 gave a significant degree of discretion to member states. And I think the Australian government was under a perception that it didn't have quite the discretion that it had, or that's sort of I think that would be the sort of the positive spin on it, or the negative spin would be to say was not necessarily in the interest to exercise that discretion and use the international sort of obligations as a sort of a nice welcome excuse to sort of introduce, should I say, robust domestic measures, or some say draconian. And the second, second point is why has it been a mess? Well, because I think as in sort of in other fields of counterterrorism legislation in Australia, the response has been extremely reactive. And the fact, and the reason for that is, again, I think a historic one, partly. I mean, I don't have time to go too much into detail here, but of course, the lack of experience with political violence or with significant political violence in Australia meant that come September 11, there was an entire sort of new situation for legislators and the government, and which led to, I think, a massive overreaction in terms of legislative response. And so that's, I think, apparent in all aspects of anti-terrorism legislation in Australia and the counterterrorism financing regulation, law and regulation is not an exception in that regard. So I have to also have to excuse my sort of rudimentary sort of knowledge of PowerPoint. I was watching a movie on a plane coming out here, and somebody sort of said in the movie, if you're born sort of prior to 1980, then it's already too late for you to keep up with sort of technology of the 21st century. So that was kind of I was redeemed by that, but nonetheless, I'm afraid I can't sort of construct nice diagrams and the like. But I could use some. I was able to use a couple of different colors to illustrate some of my points. Okay. So basically, what are the sources of law? And I think two other sort of points I'd like to make before picking up on some of these issues in more detail is that I think what you have to remember when we're talking about the Australian situation is that we don't have a domestic Human Rights Act or a domestic Bill of Rights. We don't have constitutional protection of human rights. So the entire legislative dialogue and debate and the development of laws takes place in the absence of any kind of procedural consideration of human rights, which partly, I think, explains some of the drastic aspects of it, and which also explains some of the breadth that we'll see in some of the counterterrorism financing provisions. So we didn't have, if you compare it to the United Kingdom, there's no sort of reason for the Australian government to consider as to whether it meets requirements of proportionality and the like. Australia is a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But again, there is no equivalent domestic piece of legislation such as the Human Rights Act. And so I think, again, as a sort of a general observation, which I think has a direct impact on the development of these laws, we don't see the same amount of sort of energy and enthusiasm as far as sort of that we see in terms of the security aspects of international obligations sort of develop to a similar extent as far as this, sort of the human rights components are concerned. The second sort of framework or sort of contextual remark I have to make is that Australia is, of course, a federal system, and the primary sort of legislative competence as far as criminal law is concerned rests with states. But you'll see here, basically all of the sort of counterterrorism financing legislation or generally counterterrorism legislation is federal. So how come? Well, basically, states have sort of given up specifically their competence as far as terrorism-related criminal law is, and provide Commonwealth with that power. Why is it significant? Well, that goes to the last point, if I get there, of my presentation, is that you still have sort of a kind of residual mechanisms or sort of analog or parallel mechanisms that could potentially play out at the state level, which complicates the operation of the federal system. Now, to this date, I have to say, and as I said, this is sort of the work in progress part of the paper, I think I can tell you we haven't seen any kind of counterterrorism financing attempts to sort of prosecute under state level law. I think that, why haven't we seen that? Well, first of all, because the federal system is extensive, and second point that I think goes back to my thesis, Clive may remember, a point that I've been making for a long time is to say we don't have a terrorism problem anyway. So the numbers of people that could be sort of prosecuted under legislation is generally fairly low in comparison, certainly, to other jurisdictions. Okay, so but point here is, I think if you're looking at the the sources of law and as the system as it operates, you can, as I said earlier, I think you can basically distinguish between three pillars, if you want. And again, apologies that I couldn't sort of visualize those pillars on the slide, but this is where sort of I've tried to use a different shades of blue to depict the federal level and red as the state level, and then you have the three other pillars that I think are sort of the legal, the criminal law regime, to which the first three bullet points on the slide relate. And then you have the sort of regulatory regime, which the kind of turquoise bit of legislation relates, and then you have the sort of state level state level asset confiscation recovery legislation, which is not counterterrorism or counterterrorism financing legislation per se, but because of the way some of the state law is phrased, I think a point could be made, or sort of you can at least sort of conceive of a situation where that sort of regime, specifically the Criminal Assets Recovery Act in New South Wales, I took that as an example, could possibly be used to sort of deal with terrorism-related asset freezing as well. Okay, so I don't want sort of need you to sort of read through the entire act. I mean, I said this time before, I think the quality of a legislative drafter, I think you can always measure by the length of the provision. And the first one is okay, but I didn't sort of bother to provide some other provisions further down the track because they get sort of run about sort of one provision runs to possibly two pages. So, but the point here is, I think if you're looking at the federal system, you have, and that's why I said it's a mess, you have six different provisions dealing with sort of counterterrorism financing issues. You have two in the sort of two with subsections in the in sort of the Criminal Code Act in Division 103. Then you have that sort of relates to I think the purpose of a specific conduct. Then you have another, and I'll come to them in a second. Well, I might do so now. You have two other provisions relating to a sort of association or sort of link to organization. And then you have two further as part of the Charter of the UN Act, which is the piece of legislation that implements domestically the obligations, the international obligations, including those under 1373. And 1267, and partly with sort of also deals with FATF stuff. I should say the FATF has also had a significant impact on sort of the development of standards in Australia, both legal and regulatory. I'll come back to that, in fact, in a second. But the starting point really is an amendment to the Criminal Code Act in 2002. As a sort of direct response to September 11 and 1373, to introduce a provision that criminalizes the usage provision of funds to facilitate or engage in a terrorist act. There's a reason why I sort of highlighted again in colours those parts of the provision, because that goes to the sort of the fact that intent is not required, and sort of recklessness is sufficient. And basically, I think what you have across the six provisions is mostly sort of usage of recklessness, and as far as the UN Charter is concerned. It's a strict liability. So it's already a very sort of aggressive regime in the sense that intent is not necessarily required, and recklessness is defined in the Criminal Code Act as well. Now, so the first provision, 103, as I say, was introduced as part of direct response to 9/11 and requirements of Security Council Resolution 1373. But it was found by the FATF in 2004, I think, or 5. I think I can't remember the date of the report, but in 2004, it was found to be not sufficient to meet the sort of the special recommendations of the FATF, which required sort of using the term a terrorist. Now, that presented already a dilemma, because Australian legislation doesn't use the term terrorist per se. It uses the term person committing an offence, a terrorism act, which explains sort of, I think, also the wording in that second amendment of the Criminal Code Act in relation to that matter, where the provision is called financing a terrorist, which is a term that doesn't appear anywhere else. And if you look at the offence as well, it's again sort of the usage of the term person, which has been chosen by. I'm already running out of time, so the point is we have sort of these two provisions, which are sort of concern the purpose of the provision of funds, and then we have two others which concern getting funds to, from, or for a terrorist organization. Now here, this provision interacts with other parts of the Criminal Court Act, Commonwealth, specifically those section that deals with the definition of terrorist organization. Now there are two ways for there to be sort of a terrorist organization. First is one where the prosecution can establish that an organization which is not listed either by domestic or international instruments nonetheless amounts to a terrorist organization. So it's simply up for the prosecution to prove or demonstrate that an organization is in fact a terrorist organization. Terrorist organizations can be designated by the Australian government. We have currently 20 organizations designated as terrorist organization, and it picks up a point I think that Aldrich made. So we also have a mess with lists, right? So because we have a list of terror organizations which goes sort of corresponds to that specific provision, then we have a list relating to 1373, then of course we have the 1267 and other lists which come in as part of the UN Charter, UN Charter Act. And so we have sort of a range of lists which also goes to the point that it's very difficult for an individual to in fact find out or identify which sort of behavior is permitted and which what not. So it might be permitted under one list, but might at the same time be captured by another. So it's very difficult, I think, in terms of clarity for an individual to really appreciate what is permissible and what is not. Now, the third aspect sort of is what I've already sort of referred to, Section 20 and Section 21 of the Charter of the United Nations Act, and these are the provisions that implement 1373 and 1267 into Australian law. If you are a quick reader and you have a keen eye, then you may have already noticed that there is a significant discrepancy in terms of penalty across the various provisions as well, which is another point of concern. If you're thinking back to Article 103, the term is life imprisonment. Section 103, the term is life imprisonment, right? With 102, it's 25 or 15 years. Here we have 10 years. And so basically my colleague Nicola McGarrity at the University of New South Wales has been arguing, I think, quite correctly that the least you can do in the absence of significant legislative reform, which I don't see quite happening given our experience, is to sort of harmonise penalties, which doesn't touch with the substance, but at least harmonises some of the punitive impact on it, but not much happening in that regard. Okay, in my 1 minute, which is remaining, I'm going to skip let me spend 10 seconds on the regulatory aspects of it. Basically, I think it's operating in accordance with FATF recommendations, so it's fairly elaborate. It's sort of monitored by AUSTRAC, which is a sort of a regulatory body that's sort of overseeing the implementation of it. I think it's working fine. The problem from an academic perspective is, again, access to information. So there has been sort of some indication that that some banks' accounts have been sort of cancelled on the basis of suspicious transaction. And there was even one case, which I think I have on another slide, where Visotel RIA became, in last year, it became the first money transfer business to have license suspension by AUSTRAC due to suspicion of financing of terrorism. in my probably 40 seconds remaining, I think what's important to keep in mind, and I think something I've mentioned earlier, up to this date, or last time I checked, which is I think a few months ago, 10 people had been charged with no charges under Section 103, okay, which I think is interesting. 11 people are charged with Section 1026 offences, three convictions, three to be tried. Three additional people charged under Section 1026 and Sections 20-21, but the charges under 1026 were withdrawn by the prosecutions. The latter case concerned the provision of funds to the LTTE in Sri Lanka in the aftermath with the aim of sort of providing sort of humanitarian aid in disaster relief. So the point is not many prosecutions, I think, which can signal a variety of things. An old point that I've always been trying to make is where maybe it sort of signals that we're not having sort of a significant problem. The second is, which I think the prosecution would say, is, well, in fact, and that's a point I haven't had time to go into in more detail, but which I'm happy to take up in question time, is that, you know, you might have think that from a human rights perspective, sort of the recklessness standard is pretty sort of concerning. Well, the prosecution tells you the other way around. It tells you it's not all the recklessness stuff. We'd like to have a strict liability because we can't can't prove recklessness as far as conduct is concerned. So that might also explain why 103 has not been sort of used by the prosecution much, and they have also been sort of hesitant to proceed with 102. And in the case of the Sri Lankan case, it relied on the UN Charter. Final point is a work in progress. I think what we have seen in Australia in general is, and I think it's also not germane to Australia, if you look at the history of anti-terrorism legislation in Northern Ireland, and I refer to sort of Clive's extensive work on the issue, is that we've seen, in other parts, we've seen a migration of counter-terrorism laws into other areas of law. I just used the sort of the word bikie legislation. You may have come across it in Australia. I don't think we have seen that in as far as sort of the sort of financing of terrorism is concerned. But that's sort of a work in progress. I mean, a student of mine and myself, we're sort of tracking all sort of relevant states legislation to see whether there has been any sort of migration of the ideas of the counterterrorism financing regime. But I suspect there isn't. The second aspect of the project is to investigate as to whether states-based legislation can be misused for counterterrorism financing purposes. And again, I think it is possible, but we haven't found any evidence at this stage that this is the case. Sorry for being 1 minute over time. Thank you for your attention.